Picture this, if you will. You're a primary care physician seeing a 54-year-old patient 1 month after his visit to a urology clinic. Over the past year, he's had recurrent kidney stones, and you're eager to hear what the urologist recommended. Your patient's actually not had a single kidney stone this last month, and he says he's been drinking plenty of water and avoiding certain leafy greens as instructed. You open his pharmacy record to send his prescription refills, and you notice a new medication that you never prescribed. Hydrochlorothiazide? You ask. Did the urologist prescribe that? The patient makes a face. Yeah, and I have no idea what he's thinking. A water pill? I don't have leg swelling. I have kidney stones. So I haven't been taking it. How will you explain to him the way a thiazide diuretic helps reduce the chances of passing another kidney stone? And welcome to Audio Bricks. Today, we're going to talk about the dynamic world of calcium and phosphate metabolism. But first, a quick shout out to the learning platform that makes Audio Bricks possible, the RX Bricks, which is the source of all the content you hear on this podcast. And if you've been holding off on checking this out, well, now we're running a promotion where you can get a full RX Bricks subscription for 50% off using the code RXPOD. That's RXPOD, you know, like the RX podcast. The link to the bricks is in the show notes, along with the code if you forgot how to spell it already. After completing this section, you'll be able to 1. Identify the major storage pools of calcium and phosphate. 2. Identify the normal physiologic range of dietary calcium and phosphate intake and describe the major routes of calcium and phosphate loss from the body. 3. Describe how calcium exists in bound and free forms and what factors affect this relationship. And 4. Describe the roles of parathyroid hormone, calcitriol, and calcitonin in maintaining circulating levels of calcium and phosphate. Part 1. How does the body balance calcium and phosphate? When people think of calcium, they generally think of the bones. Not surprising, since over 99% of the body's calcium is found in bone. But it's also a critical part of many other processes, such as muscle contraction and blood clotting. Phosphate, which is like calcium's less sexy cousin, is the other major component of bone mineral along with calcium. In its ionic form, it mediates a variety of cellular activities, including muscle contraction and oxygen release from red blood cells. But it's probably best known for its role in the high-energy bond of the molecule adenosine triphosphate. You know, ATP, the one that serves as the energy currency of the cell. To understand calcium and phosphate homeostasis, you need to know how dietary intake, renal and gastrointestinal excretion, and storage in the massive repository that is the human skeleton are balanced. Regarding intake, our bodies require approximately 1.5 grams per day of dietary calcium to maintain normal bodily functions. This intake is balanced equally by gastrointestinal loss of about 1.3 grams in the feces and a loss of about approximately 0.2 grams in the urine. We need about 1 to 2 grams of phosphate daily to maintain health, but most of us consume about 3 times that, mostly in the form of meats and grains. And unlike calcium, phosphate excretion happens only in the kidneys. Once inside the body, most calcium and phosphate is incorporated into the bone mineral hydroxyapatite, a molecule made up of 10 calcium, 6 phosphate, and 2 hydroxide ions. 99% of the body's calcium and 86% of the body's phosphate is found in hydroxyapatite. Almost all the rest is contained inside cells. Only about 0.1% of all calcium and phosphate is found in the extracellular fluid, both in the intravascular and extravascular compartments. All right, here's an easy one to see if you're paying attention. What is the primary storage site for both calcium and phosphate? If you said bones, you'd be correct. Part 2. How do calcium and phosphate circulate in the blood? Despite the fact that less than 0.1% of calcium and phosphate exist in the extracellular fluid, these circulating levels are the most important in bodily functions. Let's start with calcium. The circulating, or serum calcium, exists in three main forms in the blood: protein-bound, ionized, and complexed to bicarbonate or phosphate buffers. Half of all serum calcium is transported into the serum as dissolved free cations, and this fraction is most relevant for medicine since it's free to interact with organic molecules. This free fraction can be measured directly. Almost half, or about 45% of the serum calcium, is transported through the bloodstream bound to proteins like albumin or globulins, so it's not directly available for metabolic action or for renal filtration or excretion. Finally, about 5% of the calcium is bound to phosphate or bicarbonate in soluble form, so that can be filtered and excreted just like the ionic form can. So, just to review, what are the three forms of serum calcium? That would be ionized or free calcium, protein-bound calcium, and complexed calcium bound to blood anions like phosphate or bicarbonate. The circulating phosphate is not bound to proteins, so all of it is available for renal filtration. And this is particularly important since phosphate, remember, is only renally excreted. No GI excretion takes place. All right, another calcium question. Of the calcium in the blood, what percent is biologically active? Roughly half the serum calcium is the biologically active ionized or free calcium. The other half is mostly protein-bound with a small fraction complexed with organic ions. So, how do we measure calcium in clinical practice? Well, as a practicing clinician, there's two values you'll typically see. First, there's the total serum calcium, which measures the total calcium in the serum, including what is bound to proteins. This is the calcium value that you'll get when you order the ubiquitous Chem-8, or basic metabolic panel. You can also order an ionized serum calcium, which measures only the free calcium. Functionally speaking, though, only this fraction is biologically active. A high ionized calcium is the one that leads to kidney stones, and a low ionized calcium is the one that leads to hyperreflexia, like with the Schwastik sign. You get the idea. It's the most biologically relevant calcium value. Unfortunately, you only get this value if you specifically order it, or on a blood gas sample. So, approximately speaking, the total calcium is simply the sum of the ionized calcium and the protein-bound calcium. Now here's the thing. Because albumin is the main blood protein to which calcium binds, the albumin concentration approximates the capacity of serum proteins to bind calcium. Which means that, practically speaking, if the serum albumin is normal, then the total calcium level is approximately reflective of the ionized serum calcium level. In other words, if albumin is normal, high total calcium implies high ionized calcium, and low total calcium implies low ionized calcium. But low albumin levels, or hypoalbuminemia, are super common with a lot of disease states. Malnutrition, nephrotic syndrome, liver failure. And whenever albumin is low, the total calcium no longer correctly approximates the ionized calcium. Low albumin means a low amount of calcium bound to albumin, so you might have a low total calcium, but if you have a low serum albumin as well, that might be the only reason that the total calcium value is low. The ionized serum calcium may still be normal. Fortunately in this situation, to figure out whether or not the total calcium level really reflects a normal ionized calcium, we can use this correction formula. The corrected calcium is equal to 0.8 times the difference between a patient's albumin and a normal albumin level, plus the serum calcium level. It's also worth mentioning that while approximately half the total calcium is bound to proteins and the other half is free, the serum pH has the potential to affect that ratio. Like ionized calcium, hydrogen ions are also cations that can bind to negative charges present on albumin. The general rule of thumb is that if there are more hydrogen ions than normal, they can displace the calcium ions from the albumin. So, while hydrogen ions obviously don't create more total calcium, they can increase the proportion of ionized calcium and decrease the proportion of calcium bound to proteins. So tell me, if a patient's pH is 7.2 instead of 7.4, would you expect the proportion of ionized calcium to be higher or lower? So a pH of 7.2 is more acidotic than normal, so that's more hydrogen ions to displace calcium from albumin. Therefore, the proportion of ionized calcium will be higher than expected. So, blah blah blah, there's a lot of reasons why total calcium doesn't reflect ionized calcium. Who cares? Well, it's more than just the correction formula. Remember that the total calcium level is the value that usually comes with the basic metabolic panel, which is ordered on almost every patient you draw labs from. But if a calcium abnormality is suspected, or if you know the albumin or pH is going to be abnormal, you should always specifically order an ionized calcium level as well. This eliminates the need for a correction formula, and you'll get the true concentration of the free calcium that causes the symptoms of hyper or hypocalcemia. Part 3. What hormonal controls affect the calcium and phosphate homeostasis? Now let's take a look at how hormonal controls function to maintain appropriate level of these ions in our blood. Calcium levels are maintained between 8.5 and 10.2 milligrams per deciliter, and phosphate levels are maintained between 2.5 and 4.5 milligrams per deciliter. Abnormal calcium levels can cause severe problems with cognition, muscle contraction, and cardiac conduction, while abnormal phosphate levels tend to cause problems with muscle contraction and the release of oxygen from red blood cells. So the circulating calcium level is regulated primarily by parathyroid hormone, calcitriol, or vitamin D, and calcitonin, while the circulating phosphate level is mainly determined by parathyroid hormone, calcitriol, and the bone-derived growth factor FGF23. Don't worry about that one too much. We're not going to go into it. Let's start instead with parathyroid hormone, or PTH. PTH is important for controlling both serum calcium and phosphate, and it's critical to maintaining bone health. If I had to describe the role of PTH in a nutshell, it's to maintain the levels of serum calcium at all costs. When the parathyroid glands sense hypocalcemia, they release parathyroid hormone to stop the kidneys from excreting calcium, then quickly increase the serum calcium by telling the osteoclasts to break down bone mineral. And they increase phosphate excretion in the kidneys to prevent serum calcium from mineralizing. Remember, breaking down bone mineral also releases a lot of phosphate, which needs to be excreted to preserve the level of serum calcium. Parathyroid hormone also indirectly increases gut absorption of calcium via vitamin D, but we'll discuss that a little bit later. Now on to calcitriol, or vitamin D. But before we go into its effects, let's talk a little bit about how it's synthesized. Calcitriol is the metabolically active form of vitamin D, which has to go through two activation steps where a hydroxyl group is added to have any effect in the body. The original vitamin D is either ingested from food sources or synthesized in the skin upon exposure to sunlight. It then enters the circulation, travels to the liver, and is either stored or undergoes its first hydroxylation to calcifediol. Finally, it travels to the kidneys where it undergoes its second hydroxylation in the proximal tubules, forming calcitriol. This final activation step is the one that's stimulated by parathyroid hormone, as we alluded to earlier. Now, if parathyroid hormone is primarily concerned with raising the levels of serum calcium as quickly as possible, then calcitriol is primarily concerned with acquiring the substrate required to build bone mineral. And unlike parathyroid hormone, that means both calcium and phosphate. Calcitriol increases the absorption of calcium and phosphate in the small intestine and stops their excretion by the kidneys. Counterintuitively, calcitriol also increases bone osteoclast activity, just like PTH. But since calcitriol increases serum levels of both calcium and phosphate, the osteoblasts and osteocytes are provided with both substrates needed to create bone mineral as well. And the net effect is to increase bone turnover. With PTH, osteoclast activity increases breakdown of bone mineral, but since PTH promotes excretion of phosphate, the osteoblasts and osteocytes no longer have both substrates needed to synthesize bone, so the calcium preferentially stays in the serum. Finally, vitamin D inhibits PTH secretion, limiting its bone-destroying effects. Now, PTH and calcitriol are the two main hormones that work to balance serum calcium levels with bone health, PTH being primarily concerned with serum calcium level, and calcitriol being primarily concerned with the acquisition of bone substrate. A good example of this interaction occurs with vitamin D deficient patients. Low levels of calcitriol result in hypocalcemia by means of reduced gut absorption and renal reabsorption of calcium. PTH, then, needs to increase to compensate for the low serum calcium, but without vitamin D, it relies heavily on bone breakdown to maintain serum calcium levels. And since it can't completely compensate for the lack of vitamin D, the patient remains somewhat hypocalcemic, but with weak demineralized bones that come from stripping the bones of calcium and dumping the phosphate needed to create bone mineral. In adults, this leads to osteomalacia, and in children, this leads to a bone deformity known as rickets. Pop quiz time. What are the phases of synthesis and hydroxylation required to generate fully activated calcitriol? Inactive vitamin D is first synthesized either in the skin or absorbed in the GI tract, then hydroxylated in the liver to form calcifediol, and finally hydroxylated in the kidneys to form calcitriol. Finally, we come to calcitonin, the body's mechanism for correcting calcium levels when they're too high. Calcitonin is released by the parafollicular, or C cells, in the thyroid gland when they sense hypercalcemia. It specifically opposes PTH's resorptive effects in the bone osteoclasts, resulting in net bone formation. It also inhibits renal reabsorption of calcium, and combined with the decreased release of calcium from the bone, this results in decreased serum calcium levels. Remember, calcitonin puts calcium back on the bones. All three hormones, parathyroid hormone, calcitriol, and calcitonin, have effects on three different organ systems: the bone, the kidneys, and the GI tract. And each one impacts ion concentrations in our blood. Check out the table in the brick titled Calcium and Phosphate Regulation for a great summary as to each hormone's net effects on calcium and phosphate. And that's a wrap. Let's see how much you learned about calcium and phosphate in this section. First, can you list the three main sites where calcium is found in the body, as well as the three main forms of circulating calcium? About 99% of calcium is found in the bone mineral hydroxyapatite, 1% is found inside the cells themselves, and only about 0.1% circulates in the extracellular fluid. That 0.1% of circulating calcium, though, has three forms. Half is found as free or ionized calcium, and a little less than half is bound to blood proteins. 5% is complexed with organic anions. Second, can you name two pathologic conditions that affect the relative proportions of bound to ionized calcium in the serum? Hypoalbuminemia, unsurprisingly, decreases the proportion of protein-bound calcium. Acidosis also decreases the proportion of protein-bound calcium, since hydrogen ions simply displace calcium from albumin. Alkalosis, by default, does the opposite. And this is important to understand, since most basic lab panels measure the total serum calcium, even though it's the free ionized calcium that truly reflects whether the patient is physiologically hyper or hypocalcemic. When albumin and pH are normal, the total calcium is an adequate reflection of the ionized calcium, but when these pathologic conditions occur, you have to account for an altered proportion of free to bound calcium. Or better yet, stop guessing and just order an ionized calcium level. Third, how do the distribution and excretion of phosphate differ from those of calcium? So while phosphate is also primarily found in hydroxyapatite, a much larger fraction, about 14%, is found inside cells. And unlike calcium, circulating phosphate isn't bound at all. It's water-soluble, and as such, 100% of it can be freely filtered into the renal tubular system. Which is helpful, because unlike calcium, phosphate is only excreted by the kidneys, not the GI tract. Finally, can you briefly summarize the effects of the three main regulatory hormones on calcium and phosphate in the body? Parathyroid hormone, or PTH, increases serum calcium levels and decreases serum phosphate. Calcitriol, the active form of vitamin D, increases both serum calcium and phosphate levels. And finally, calcitonin decreases serum calcium levels. Now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's get back to our patient from the intro. A 54-year-old male patient of yours was prescribed a thiazide diuretic to reduce the incidence of kidney stones, but has been non-compliant with the medication. How will you explain its effects on calcium homeostasis in a way that convinces him to take his medications? You explain to your patient that, yes, hydrochlorothiazide is a water pill. It increases urine output. But it also decreases the amount of calcium excreted in the urine. Less calcium floating around in the urine, you explain, means less calcium available to form stones. You see, calcium is the primary mineral that makes up your bones. Because whenever it gets a chance, it likes to bind to other molecules to make these really hard, rocky chunks. And while that's good for bone, hard chunks of stuff don't really belong in the kidneys. He winces a little, remembering how those hard chunks felt traveling down his ureters. But he nods, and says he'll take his medications. He doesn't want that experience ever again. You're a couple minutes late to your next appointment, but you're glad you took the time to explain to your patient. At the end of the day, patients spend only a small fraction of their lives under your direct care. For most of their lives, they need to take responsibility for maintaining their own health, and taking the time to educate and empower your patients to make good health choices is a time investment that you know will prevent frustration and worse medical outcomes in the long run. And that's our show. Make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts if you like what you heard. Remember, your feedback helps us improve. And again, now's your chance to get 50% off the RX Bricks by following the link in the show notes below and typing in the promo code RXPOD, like RX Podcast. It's a huge discount on the written material that serves as the foundation of Audio Bricks, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. And help us keep Audiobricks free. Until next time, friends.